You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And. We welcome Martha Jones back to the podcast. She is the Society of Black Alumni, Presidential Professor, and Professor of History at the SNF Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins University. We spoke to her last about her book, Vanguard, and she has got this amazing new book, which is called The Trouble of Color, an American Family Memoir. So she digs into her family's past, which tells a story about race in America and all sorts of revelations and secrets and lies and truths. I mean, it's really, and she's so thoughtful. You're really going to enjoy this pod.
Another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
But Martha Jones, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks for having me back.
Your beautiful and sorrowful and harrowing new book is a family memoir that also acts as a kind of poetic history lesson about race in this country. And I want to start our conversation with something you write at the end of the book in your afterword. You write, quote, "I discovered my faith and the capacity of words to help me know myself and the people who made me. I started this book without anyone from whom to seek permission. My elders were all gone. All I had was the belief that if I dedicated the best of myself to them, to their memories, and to making sense of their lives, the result would be a tribute worthy of all they were, of all they endured along the color line." Okay, you get to the end of writing this book. Did you feel you accomplished your task?
I do, at least on most days. And that's because, as you know, books go through many iterations. Mm-hmm. And this book is no exception. So you're reading a version, I don't know if it's version 5 or 6 or 7 or 8, depends on which section. But I know the journey to getting the words right and to getting the words to a place where I could convey knowledge and understanding and insight into the past, but that I could also confront the concerns and the regard that my ancestors tried to establish for themselves in a very troubled, roiling world, and at the same time honor my own feelings. So that doesn't happen, at least not for me, in the first draft. And at the same time, I have to say that if I have... it's not exactly a regret, but if I have a reflection now on the other side of the book and it's between the covers and it is what it is, I keep discovering new small tidbits that I wish I could have included in there. And so so I think, like many writers, once the book is put to bed, I'm someone who keeps surfacing things that are great to talk about, but won't make it into the book itself.
There's, you know, you take us on this journey where clearly you're surprised by things that you find, and we're surprised by the things you find. And I talk about this with my wife because our parents are both gone, and we both recall moments as adults where we're in this conversation, and this was one that my wife talks about because her dad entered the war. He lied about his age and entered World War II. And she knew that story. What she didn't know is that he worked for MacArthur. And she's like, how did this never come up that you work with Douglas MacArthur? You were his top aide.
Absolutely.
And your history, I guess it all starts with the birth of Nancy Bell Graves in 1808. Is that where we maybe start this? And can you maybe talk about her? Let's start to know some of these people.
Sure. You know, Nancy Bell Graves for most of my life was a photograph tucked into an envelope along with many, many other old family photos. And it was a very long time before I recognized her as likely the oldest of the ancestors. She's born, as you said, in 1808 in Danville, Kentucky. She's born enslaved into a roiling and expansive slaveholding household. But she has her own children. She marries after the Civil War. She raises children and grandchildren there in Danville. And really, for me, from the outset, introduces the question that this book asks, or that I ask myself, and which is, you know, how do we come to look the way we do? And so Nancy's story is also a challenging story because the part we don't tell so readily, the part that wasn't openly shared, was the way in which she and other women in her family were part of slaveholding households in which slaveholding men took sexual advantage of enslaved women. Those women bore children. Their skin bore the mark of that sexual violence. And Nancy's skin, which comes to me through this photograph that I had been carrying around for so long, really opens the book and opens the question of how it is that we come to look the way we do as Black Americans. And it is partly, but only partly, a story of these troubled years in the early 19th century.
And one of those things is that you thought you had four kids, right?
Yes.
But there was more.
There were so many more, and this is one of those moments when, I'm trained as a historian to rely upon many kinds of official records, and so I began to use things like the census to count Nancy's children, and I think I got to seven at one point, but then. I was also collecting stories of other women in my family who spoke about Nancy. And now they remember her children as 14 rather than the seven I was able to find. And here the dilemma is who's telling the better story, right? Who's telling the story that you're going to go with as a writer, as a descendant? And I had to give up, in a sense, my historian's instinct, which was to rely on the census and death certificates and the kinds of records that many of us turn to when we're trying to reconstruct a family past, but to honor someone like my father's sister, my Aunt Tuppy, who remembered that Nancy had seven daughters, not four daughters. Mm-hmm. To recognize that she was carrying a memory that no official record would document for me, but nonetheless was a story that I felt obliged to try and tell, even to tell it in the face of absence.
I think we're close in age, and I had to do an assessment. I did this like personality assessment thing the other day for work, and it was asking questions about like race, gender, all, and the list was so long. And I remember the last time I did these sorts of things was when I was much younger, like going for a passport or whatever, when the list used to be like two or three. And this comes across in your book where it's like, what are people called? What are their choices? And it's just it speaks to such a different time, which then speaks to a different perception, a different reality than exists today.
Yeah, and I think that as we do today, I think what I discovered about people like Nancy, her daughters, and the generations that follow is that really who we are, and I put that in quotes, who we are is this exchange between who we know ourselves to be, the people around us, those who we call family or kin on the one hand, and on the other hand, what officialdom dubs us to be, right? And officialdom is only interested in some categories and not others. It works with limited categories. You know, I've lived long enough to see the census change from check one box to check as many boxes as you'd like when it comes to race. Well, that's a sea change, and it's complicated, but it doesn't substitute at the same time for the way we know ourselves to be or the way we understand our families. But we're definitely in dialogue with those kinds of instruments all the time. And there's been a bit of a dust up around the 2020 census, which had recorded an astronomical number of people who had reported themselves to be of mixed race. And then a set of social scientists went in and looked closely at the methodology of the Census Bureau and basically exposed that there had been an algorithmic error introduced, and they had over-reported the number of people. So that's a really graphic example of the ways in which officialdom can't be the last word, shouldn't be the last word. And in my case, that means, did Nancy have four daughters? Did she have five daughters? Did she have seven daughters? Well, probably the women who knew her, right, and who heard her stories firsthand knew better than any Census Bureau report that might later on try and capture her life story.
One of the characters in this book, and if there's ever a film made, who plays the bishop, right? I mean, this is what an amazing figure.
Yeah. So this is my grandfather's older brother, who was indeed a bishop, among the very first Black American bishops in the Methodist, what was then the Methodist Episcopal Church North. But the bishop is a storyteller. He's a learned man. He's a distinguished man. And I am very much in conversation with him in this book, because at first I think I'm going to rely quite faithfully on the stories that he told about himself, but also about his parents and his grandparents. He is the son of a formerly enslaved woman. But as I dig and search and collect more stories, I have to begin to politely, respectfully disagree with the bishop. For example, the bishop speaks of his family and basically says, we were always free. We come from free people, not enslaved people. Well, it wasn't hard for me to know that the bishop's own mother had, her, in fact, been born enslaved in eastern North Carolina and was freed only with the emancipation after the Civil War. Do I write that down? Do I disagree with him? Well, the answer is yes. But I also, at the same time, felt it was important to respect that story, the story he told, and to understand how, as a Black man in the early 20th century, looking to build a career, looking to be a person of influence in the midst, at the height of Jim Crow, for him, there was some ambivalence, wasn't there, about telling too much about that chapter in the family past that was so bound up with slavery and its exploitations. So I'm a different generation, right? And a generation in which I think we are less bound by the reticence and by the shame that might have been part of his world. And I can tell the story, not only his story, but the story of his mother. But he's a formidable man, let me say, in my, you know, young life, because he was so highly regarded by my father, by my grandmother and others. It took me some writing and rewriting to really fully confront his story with my own.
There's a thing, too, as I was reading the book, it felt like you developed a kind of grace for the unreliable narrators in the past, that you extended that to them. Yeah, it seems like you're frustrated by it at first and like, no. But that, at a certain point, you're like, yeah, well, and because we all are to a certain degree in our as we struggle with the way we grew up and how we understand it. And it does change over time. I mean, this, and no one tells you that. You don't grow up understanding that that's going to be the case, because it, like so much in this book, it goes unsaid.
Yeah, I don't know about your family, but in my family, you know, there were a handful of stories that were told again and again and again, and they're wonderful stories and they're meaningful stories. But part of the quest of this book was to really fill that out. And then it turns out, as you say, it turns out you find yourself testing those stories. And I think that there was, for me, something, I learned things by testing those stories, things that surprised me. I had a great grandmother who told many times the story that she was the granddaughter of John Jacob Astor. Now, for folks who don't know who John Jacob Astor was, in 19th century America, Astor was first a fur merchant and later a real estate tycoon in New York and dubbed by many the richest man in America. Well, that story, for a long time, I think for many of us, just sounded like pure myth.
Yeah.
How could that be true? But when I took her seriously and I set to working on how that, in fact, might be true, I discovered things I would have otherwise never known. And folks have to read the book to see whether I persuade you and how you come down on that story. But I think that less important in the end was the wholesale veracity of the story, but that she was telling this story as a way to deflect us from how, in fact, she was the child of a slaveholder, that her owner had had a troubled relationship with her mother, and she was the child of a man who called her property. Well, that might not be a story that you'd want to tell about yourself.
Right. Right.
But maybe a story about John Jacob Astor is one that better suits you as you're making your way as a freed person, as a mother, as a community member, and more. And so I learned some things about her and the world she lived in by taking even that seemingly fanciful story seriously.
We're recording this podcast, and we're in maybe the second week, I guess, of the fires in Los Angeles. And
yes.
I'm sure you know people who've lost everything. I know people who've lost everything.
And, oh, my goodness.
And we have this conversation about, well, they're just things. But they're not just things, because we carry things with us through generations. I thought about this morning when I was going to talk to you about the China. And you inherited this China, there it is, the cup. I love that you got that right there. Can you talk a little bit about that story in terms of where that came from and your relationship with it now based on what you discovered?
Yeah. I think it's probably something a lot of us can relate to, with some humor, right? The family artifacts that nobody's sure they really want. Do you really want in the 21st century a set of ancient, delicate China settings for 12? And what the heck are you going to do with those things? But I am the one, as you suggest, right, who's been collecting a lot of things. And when my siblings didn't want the China and my parents didn't want the China, I said, well, I'm going to take it. Now, my husband for years really chided me about this, because it remained in the boxes. And every time we moved, he was the one inevitably who was lugging the China, right, to the truck and into the house and into some storage space. And he convinced me to open it up finally. And that was really poignant, it turned out, because we began to live with it. And then I began to read the stories from my grandmother, who had inherited this china from her grandmother. And so now I'm holding on to these artifacts and inviting my family and my friends to take meals from these artifacts that are an embodiment of a woman, Susan Davis, who is born enslaved in Kentucky in 1840, but lives with her family, with her children, with her into freedom, and in her everyday life in Danville, serves guests, serves members of her women's club and more on this china. My grandmother will do much the same at her home in North Carolina, where she is the wife of a college president serving dignitaries, still on these same cups and serving coffee in these same cups and saucers. So I think sometimes we're not sure why we save things, you know, and why we don't pass them on to charity or, you know, give them a nice goodbye ceremony. And this china is an example of something that took a long time to reveal itself to me. But now, as you can see, I know folks can't see, I keep one cup and saucer on my desk here at home as a reminder of them and the journey that we have been on as a family.
Is it, do you use the cup every day? Is that
Absolutely.
Like reagent to your coffee?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. We've got one of those in our house. Yeah. And I thought it was interesting, too, was and had you read Franklin Fraser's book, the 1957 book, The Black Bourgeoisie, before this?
Oh, my goodness. You know, I had read as a graduate student, E. Franklin Fraser, the great one of the great black sociologists of the 20th century, a prolific scholar who in the 1950s pens what I'm going to call today a screed, but it is a considered and serious book called Black Bourgeoisie, and Black Bourgeoisie is really an indictment of a rising class of black Americans who in the 20th century are not only the beneficiaries of higher education, they are destined for professional life, and are emerging as a leadership class. Well, Franklin Fraser does not mean to flatter this group. Mm-hmm. He really means to look at them critically, and they fall short in many ways of his expectations that they would be first and foremost devoted to civic leadership and to collective interests writ large for black Americans. In Fraser's estimation, these are folks who become preoccupied with the trappings of bourgeois life in 20th century America. My grandparents knew E. Franklin Fraser. They hosted him on the campus of Bennett College, where my grandfather was president for many years in the 20th century. And I have to imagine what that confrontation was like when my grandmother serves Fraser on this fine French china that she has inherited across generations. I know for her, doing that was an embodiment of her own family's journey, their struggle, and what it meant for women out of slavery to create homes, to create families, to create community. But I fear that in Franklin's eyes, the same china symbolized a kind of pretentiousness and a superficiality. So I find, as I read Franklin's book, Fraser's, I don't know why I keep saying Franklin, Fraser's book, I'm thinking of John Hope Franklin, the historian. Mm. When I read Fraser's account and I reread it, I am really taken aback that someone could so publicly and pointedly and with such credentials call into question the lives of people who had raised me up and the lives that they bequeathed to us, including the China.
It's another duality, right? And the book is just filled with these. And we're not, as human beings, very comfortable with dualities. We want things to be one way or another. And this is all of us. And yeah. So it affects the truth. It affects the storytelling. It affects these opinions. It causes people to hide. I'm going to, for listeners who want to read the book and don't want it spoiled, like, turn this off right now. You can come back to it later. Cause I the ending of this was, I did not see this coming, and I should have, because everything you wrote leads to this, but you found your birth certificate.
Mm.
And it says you're white.
Mm-hmm.
Were you 17 when you did, like, something like that?
I was 19.
19.
I was, you know, why do we look at our birth certificates at all?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Except that I was getting ready to study abroad and I needed a passport, my first passport. And, you know, my parents charged me with taking responsibility for the paperwork, which I dutifully did. Mm-hmm. But in doing so, I had to pull that old, you know, worn birth certificate out of my parents' strong box. I don't know if anybody has a strong box still today, but these were fireproof metal boxes where, you know, middle-class families, kept their things. Thinking your reference to folks in LA, right? You know, the strong box was exactly because people feared fire. I open it and have a good look at it, I think, for the first time in my life, probably. And I realized that the doctor who delivered me marked my mother as white. Well, this is not a surprise. I know my mother to be a white woman. But he also marks my father as white. And this sends a chill right through me, not only because I know it to be incorrect, because I understand the implications for me, right? That my identity, my racial identity, in one sense, is derived from this kind of document. And the doctor got it, at least in my view, the doctor got it wrong. So what to do? And so the story is partly, you know, about a conversation with my mother, one of the very few conversations we ever had about race and color and who we were in that regard. But it also sends me on a journey to understand better how physicians are thinking about the question or the dilemma of race in the mid-20th century, when I'm born, in the 1950s. And part of what I learn is that there are African-American physicians in that generation who are very suspicious of boxes of any sort and mm-hmm. Suspect, believe, perhaps know in some instances that the information we record in those boxes might be used against us in some way. But I don't know. I can't tell you why the doctor who delivered me recorded my father is white. He knew my father. He knew he was not a white man, but he recorded him as such. And until today, that's still what my birth certificate says.
Wow. All right. And then you one-up that because you were a lawyer, so you have this lawyer's trick of being able to read upside down. Your dad passes away. Mm. And you get a glimpse at the death certificate. Was that what that?
Yes, exactly.
And what did that say in terms of his race?
Yeah. So there I am, you know, in the basement of the funeral parlor and going over last details for his service and burial. And I am reading upside down. And on the desk is the death certificate. And someone has recorded, checked the white box for my father. And, you know, in that moment, how are you feeling, right? You're emotionally spent. You're physically exhausted. My father's death was rather sudden. And so you're not wholly, you know, in your right mind, as we say. And I'm just too tired to argue, right? Or to insert myself as the funeral director is, you know, very nicely, you know, going through his litany of how the next days are going to go. But when I really reflected on it, in a funny way, or not funny, haha, but funny, curious way, as I got to know my father better in writing The Trouble of Color, I wondered if, even as I minded, that he might have been just fine with that at the end of his life, that he had come to live a life where his family history, his own identity, what he had inherited, whether it is the inheritance of slavery or Jim Crow or being raised on the college of a on the campus of a historically black college, by the end of his life, he had come to live at quite a distance from most of that. I think many people around him didn't know that he came from a so-called black family, and maybe for him it was enough. You know, it was enough to leave it just the way, you know, some physician or the undertaker saw it. We didn't see it the same way, I think, even at the end.
I imagine this wasn't an easy book to write. And I'm curious, you know, as a professor, as you know, who's also doing this very personal journey, like, did you have to distance yourself in order to, like, try to make the narrative work in the way that you needed to for the book? Or did you just, like, I'm swimming in it, and let's see what comes out?
For me, I like the way you put it. I had to swim in all of it.
Yeah.
And then discover what I thought the book was about, right? Yeah. And so there's a lot that gets left on the cutting room floor as I find the thread, and the thread through this book is about the trouble of color. It is about the way in which skin is evidence of some things and profoundly misleading when it comes to other things in the life of this family, in the life of my family. And I had to swim in all of that in order to discover the thread. And so there are certainly things that I learned, even things I wrote, that are left out. But what's really guiding me, in addition to that story, is a kind of truthfulness that I think I had not known as a historian. Now, I want to be clear to anybody listening, I don't mean to say as a historian I am untruthful. But historians, like all writers, are making choices all the time about which stories to tell and how to situate them in context. And my work has never been about probing perhaps the most troubling or difficult or personal dimensions of the historical folks I write about. But in this book, I'm really taking my lead less from historians and more from memoirists, people like Natasha Trethewey and Casey Lehman and others whose approach to memoir is that kind of unflinching truthfulness, a kind of frankness with yourself and with the past. And that is a journey, right? That is not, for me at least, that is not something I woke up experienced in doing or inclined to do. But I felt, frankly, if I'm going to go down this path, I better be prepared to really see it through wherever it takes me, rather than pulling back and telling you, I don't know, a prettier story and a more comfortable story. So I hope for readers there is in that, if not a reassurance, at least a sense of companionship, right, for anyone who is, who knows, who thinks they know, who sits with, who inherits difficult parts of a family history, we have the ability to not only know those, but to try and understand them for ourselves and have them be part of our lives, even as they are not always easy parts.
Well, I think, you know, if you have these three words, truth, history, and race in America, you can't rely on what is the truth. And because we've been grappling with it from the beginning, and we're sitting here, you know, in 2025, and still, you know, what is the conversation today? It's about what's facts, what are not facts, misinformation. Yeah. It's like we're awash in it, and then it's funny because like we're acting like that's new.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's digitized, I guess, so it can scale in certain ways, but it's not new at all. Certainly in race, but probably about most things, because, you know, who wins the war? Who tells the story? What book survives?
Yeah,
so that's a real thing.
I'll borrow from my friend and colleague, Jelani Cobb, who some years ago said, you know, we might lie about race, but it's a lie about a lie. You know, that race is its own lie. And part of what I hope people would take away from the book, you know, is that it's a deeply meaningful, powerful lie. It shapes our lives in indelible ways on the one hand. And on the other hand, it is not a system. Race and racism are not systems that we can reduce to logic, because they're not logical. And part of this story, right, is about the ways in which in every generation in my family, folks have to tell a new story, a different kind of story, about who they are and where they come from, right, to suit their own time, just as I do. And that is all truth, but it doesn't line up neatly as one consistent story. It is a series of truths, right? It's generations of truths. And I think race is one of those facets of our world that has in part remained so powerful because it has adapted, right, across the generations to the truth of a given historical moment.
For returning guests, we ask for a thank you because story to end the podcast. Do you have one for us?
I do. You know, one of the things about writing this book was that along the way, I met many generous, thoughtful, knowledgeable people who were in possession of parts of this story. What comes to mind is a genealogist in Kentucky who was trying to help me situate some of my family at a plantation just on the outskirts of Louisville called Oxmoor. And he was so eager for us to have been a part of that story at Oxmoor. And he shared family trees and lore and more. Thank you, I said, because your passion and commitment to this story and to this place is one I really share. And at the same time, my story is going to go in another direction, and it's okay with me that we're not a part of the Oxmoor story. In fact, I'm a little bit relieved, and I truly am grateful for the fellow travelers in this book, archivists, librarians, genealogists, and more, even as they might tell the story differently than I do.
I'm reading Scott Barry Kaufman's next book, which when he was describing it to me, he said it was going to be about competitive victimhood, a thing he sort of sees in the world right now. But it is much more actually lovely than that, because what it really talks about is all the hurt and all the trauma and the grief and the pain that human beings have, and our ability to reframe, our ability to take that, not deny it, and not try to tell a different story, be able to even to tell that story, will allow us to make choices in our lives that can bring growth, you know, and the term is often used as post-traumatic growth. And I feel like I felt like you got some of that by the end of the process with this book.
I really appreciate that. It really resonates with me, because this is not a book about grievance or revenge.
Nope.
In the end. It is a book about understanding. And I appreciate how it can feel like understanding is a more and more a rare commodity in our human relations. And yet, I think I would agree, at least with the part that suggests, you know, without the patience and the forbearance that understanding requires of us, without that, we are locked in, whether it's in our political world, but I would say in a family, right?
No,
within our own families, we are many of us, I think, struggling, you know, with that kind of forbearance, with that kind of patience, with that kind of compassion, even as there's a great deal of pain and strife, and even disagreement between us. But I appreciate that framing very much, and I think it certainly is here.
The book is called The Trouble of Color, an American Family Memoir. Martha Jones, thank you so much for coming on the podcast again.
Thank you so much for having me, Kelly.
Getting to Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
survive.